Welcome to Bina, KALW's program featuring creative voices from the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. In this series, we bring you remarkable artists and thinkers who've come to speak at the JCCSF as part of our Arts and Ideas program. On this edition of Bina, we feature the curatorial team of the Contemporary Jewish Museum, Heidi Rabin and Kinjin Montoya, for a conversation on art and activism as they reflect on the art and artists that are inspiring and challenging them in this moment. The discussion is part of the CJM's new series, Democracy Sounds Good, a response to ever-unfolding current events and how art and artists help shape our ongoing national conversations. And now, join Gravity Goldberg, Director of Public Programs at the CJM, as she introduces our guests.
So my name is Gravity Goldberg, and I'm the Director of Public Programs at the Contemporary Jewish Museum in San Francisco. I am pleased to welcome you to today's program, part one of the series, Democracy Sounds Good, a conversation on artists, arts, and activism. And now I'm pleased to introduce our panelists, Heidi Rabin and Kinjin Montoya. Heidi is a curator and writer based in San Francisco. She is currently senior curator at the Contemporary Jewish Museum and adjunct professor in the MFA design program at California College of the Arts. Rabin's practice includes curating, writing, editing, and research with a focus on international contemporary video and performance art. She has worked on projects in the Bay Area, Detroit, New Delhi, South Korea, and Canada. Prior to her position at the CJM, Rabin was the BICI curator in residence at the Banff Center for Arts and Creativity in Alberta, Canada, and has previously held positions as director and curator of events and exhibitions at CADIST, curatorial fellow at the CCA Wattis Institute for Contemporary Arts, and a writing fellow for the Asian Contemporary Arts Consortium. Rabin's writing has been published in After Image, Our Practical, Daily Serving, and San Francisco Arts Quarterly, as well as in exhibition catalogs and artist publications. Rabin holds a Master of Arts in Curatorial Practice from California College of the Arts and a Bachelor of Arts in Art History from the University of California, Berkeley. Kinjin Montoya is an assistant curator at the CJM. Her practice includes curating, writing, and research with a focus on institutional histories and the narratives of women and people of color. Her curatorial research has been featured in exhibitions at the Yerba Buena Center for the Arts, and in programming at the San Francisco Museum of Modern Art. She is an emerging arts professional and is the current America's Collection Research Fellow at CADIST in San Francisco. Montoya holds a Master of Arts in Curatorial Practice from California College of the Arts and a Bachelor of Arts in Art History from the University of California, Berkeley. Please welcome Heidi and Kinjin.
Thank you so much, Gravity. It's great to be able to see Gravity and Kinjin. I'm sorry I can't see more of you, but I want to say welcome to everyone and thank you all so much for choosing to spend your time with us today. As Gravity mentioned, my name is Heidi Rabin and I am the senior curator here at the CJM. I'm really thrilled to be in conversation today with Kinjin Montoya, our assistant curator who started at the CJM mere weeks before our temporary closure due to COVID-19. So thank you, Kinjin, for being with us. And I also want to just quickly thank our curatorial assistant, Ari Gelardin, whose early conversations around this topic were really influential for the conversation that we're going to have today. As curators at a museum that is physically closed right now, our aim today is to spend some time together just thinking about art and how we are engaging with it in these very challenging times. This is obviously an unusual conversation for us and likely for all of you listening for several reasons. We're not here to give you a lecture or a presentation on something that we've deeply researched together. We're not even speaking about something that is installed at the museum or an exhibition that we have been working on. Instead, we really wanted to speak a little bit more about how we're feeling while in isolation during this challenging time in our country and in the world, and the kinds of art and artists that we've been inspired by during this time. So we're really thinking of this conversation more as an introduction and a way of context setting for a series, like Gravity mentioned, that will actually engage artists in conversation about how we can process and connect in this very chaotic world. which actually requires in many ways a certain kind of isolation and disconnection for the foreseeable future. Today, we wanted to share with you a few artists who are proposing relevant ideas and exciting methods of engagement under these very fluid circumstances. And there are obviously so many amazing artists doing incredible work in the world. So we really want to be clear up front that this is just the tiniest sample of artists that are working in a variety of ways that have been inspiring to us personally and that feel especially relevant to us right now. It's in no way exhaustive. It's in no way comprehensive. We just wanted to take this time to share with you. So just to set the stage a little bit, 2020, the year 2020, has been defined by a series of unprecedented circumstances in our world, in our nation, and in our daily lives. We're in the midst of a civil rights movement. We're in the midst of a global health crisis, a destabilized economy. The sustainability of our planet continues to be actively attacked. The care and education of our children has been compromised. We don't need to go on and on, but I do think it's interesting too that we're having this conversation at the end of the week when the Democratic National Convention just concluded last night, taking place virtually for the first time. And the California wildfires are raging here, which, you know, all of us here in California are sitting here with our windows closed because of the poor air quality. And our thoughts really go out to those that have been displaced or worse by these fires. But I guess while the convergence of these circumstances certainly defines our current moment, we also want to say that they're by no means new phenomena. And as we live out these events, the foundations of our democracy are certainly being challenged. Nothing is neutral or apolitical in this landscape, if indeed it ever was. But as a museum, one of our core values is the conviction that art can move people, challenge us to expand our thinking, and inspire real change. So faced with these circumstances, we really look to artists to help us process, to see the world, to criticize, reflect on the events that are happening. And perhaps most importantly, art and artists can create space for human connection in times of crisis and offer a tangible path forward towards meaningful dialogue and growth. This is really, I think, the crux of what we aim to discuss today. So quickly, one thing I just want to say that we're hearing a lot, and even perhaps some of us are saying a lot, and that Kenshin and I kind of hope to challenge in this conversation, is the notion that art is important now more than ever. Because of course, while art is absolutely essential, we certainly would never debate that, being curators, we don't feel like it's necessarily that it's now more than ever. I think that we feel like it has always been essential. It will always be essential. It's persisted. It is one of the most enduring fundamental human impulses in the world. It's gone through many pandemics before this one, many political movements before this one, many crises of all kinds. So we just want to kind of emphasize that art will always be important and urgent. But there are aspects that of what's going on right now, and again, the kind of convergence of so many different things that really draw us to art, and that art can provide so much critical framework and reflection for. So to that end, we wanted to start out by sharing a quote from Toni Morrison, which was actually published on the occasion of the 150-year anniversary of The Nation, the publication, in the year 2004, which was actually following the election of George W. Bush, but which feels uncannily relevant to our current moment. So quote, "This is precisely the time when artists go to work. I know the world is bruised and bleeding, and though it is important not to ignore this pain, it is also important not to succumb to its malevolence. Like failure, chaos contains information that can lead to knowledge, even wisdom, like art." Unquote. So just keep that quote in mind as we kind of travel through this conversation. And with that, I would love to ask Kenshin if she could help situate us a little bit more deeply in the present.
Awesome. Thank you, Heidi and Gravity. So in the ways, as Heidi had mentioned, that our current moment of many pandemics has presented us with the unknown and things we cannot control, it has also compounded and exposed the systematic failures that have been in existence for as long as this country and these structures have been in place. For that reason, speaking the names of people like George Floyd and so many others, and invoking the lives within our most vulnerable communities in the time of COVID as well has been really important, as they are some of the victims of these longstanding structures. what I think also a conversation like this from an arts and cultural institution can do is identify when we're presented with resources, information, guides, or maps that have offered us a way of coping, which allows, you know, for fear and anger and different ways of processing, as well as care, often in the form of resilience, and healing through hope and strength. There's just been a lot to learn in the last few months. So when we talk about artists that we've really kind of turned to in these moments, this is the Radical Database by artist Angelina Ruiz. So this is kind of a way when artists, through their own methods of making, have presented people with ways to support, engage, and connect with each other. This is a directory that Angelina says in her Instagram really has something for everyone. Fundraisers, petitions, listings to Black-owned businesses, and these kinds of things have proven to be really useful in ways of connecting. So the Human 3.0 Reading List is, again, this idea of a guide or resources is by artist Colleen Smith, who we'll talk about a little bit later. And so one of the things Heidi and I felt was important about this kind of work and going to these kinds of resources is the ways many of us have turned to our screens to engage with the world, including art. And while many of us have been asked to shelter in place, there's this idea of a captive audience that really takes on a broader and more effective meaning. And something else that feels really unique to this moment when it comes to our interaction with art is our relationship with the screened and one another. In the absence of access to the experience of art in person, museums and galleries and institutions have created platforms like the Google Arts and Culture platform to engage with both analog and digital work virtually. We're predominantly experiencing art of all kinds in all mediums through screens without any human interaction. And that can present, limitations and opportunities in terms of access. This is wonderful, but this isn't also the way so many artworks have been made to be viewed. In other words, we're in a constant state of engagement and retreat with our technologies and our methods of information gathering. And the artists that we're going to talk about today have really presented expanded methodologies of questioning, of researching, of synthesizing, of making and connecting, and thus have really become retreats and challenges to the ways that we can exist at the moment in a time of many pandemics. So with that, I'll let Heidi start talking about some of these amazing artists.
So the line between artists and activists has long been a thin and blurry one. Some of you may be familiar with the term social practice, which sort of, you know, emerged as a convergence, a more sort of articulated convergence of artistic practice and social interaction or social justice in some cases. Activism or activist ideas are sometimes embedded within artwork rather than directly stated. But many artists in this moment in particular are directly stating their identification with activism. And that is sort of this kind of initial example I wanted to kick us off with, which is a very wide-reaching and action-oriented artist-led organization. So Four Freedoms. Four Freedoms was conceived initially as an artist-led super PAC leading up to the 2016 election. It was founded by artists Hank Willis Thomas, Eric Gottesman, Michelle Wu, and Wyatt Gallery. Four Freedoms is an artist-led platform that models and increases civic engagement, discourse, and direct action. So they're working with artists and with organizations to center the voices of artists in public discourse and expand on what participation in democracy looks like in an effort to really kind of reshape conversations about politics. I think that they see how prohibitive the political system, how elitist, how constrained it is and has become. And we're really responding to a lot of apathy out there in the world, especially with youth. And so they're aiming to really act as a kind of hub to connect or bridge artists, organizations, and conversations about politics and civic life, and really kind of invite people to think more deeply about politics, to participate more in politics. So one of the main things I really love about Four Freedoms is that instead of bringing a political agenda to art, they all are artists, they all make art. So rather than like inflecting their own work with politics, they're actually aiming to kind of invert that paradigm by injecting artistic thinking into politics itself, and with the belief that politics itself will learn and benefit greatly from a deeper engagement with art. something that I completely agree with. So some examples of how they do this. Back in 2018, Four Freedoms launched what they called the 50 State Initiative. It was during the midterm election season, and they held over 700 concurrent decentralized public events across the country with over 250 partners, which were, you know, in an effort to spark a national dialogue, a collective dialogue about art and education, commerce, politics, et cetera. They did this through four sort of distinct platforms: billboards, town halls, which in the way that billboards were sort of co-opting advertising space to have political conversations and use them as sort of canvases to display art. They're doing the same thing with the town hall format, which is traditionally a political format, an opportunity to really dig into different issues in specific locations. They also hosted exhibitions, and they also did collaborations with organizations or with individuals around creating interactive lawn signs. So signs that you would place in your lawn, if you had a lawn, I don't, to endorse a candidate during an election. The CJM actually participated when we actually hosted a Four Freedoms event around sort of these lawn signs. For us, we just posted them up in our lobby, and we engaged with people in our lobby in a conversation about what freedom meant to them. We invited them to fill out one of four different prompts, either freedom from, freedom of, freedom to, or freedom for. These represent the four freedoms in the name, the pun of the name. And yeah, we did this on election day in 2018. So it was really about both, you know, encouraging people to vote if they hadn't already. And if they had, you know, what was on their mind? What are they thinking about? Why are they here at the museum? What did they come for? It was also in conversation with an artwork by the artist Uxosi Iofemi, who had a solo exhibition up at the CJM at that time called Black Matter. So myself and Uxosi were sitting in the lobby and were there to engage with people and see what they had to say. So more recently, Four Freedoms has really started to occupy gigantic advertising space. And this is kind of the best example of that in Times Square. This was a collaboration between one of my favorite artists, Christine Sun Kim, Four Freedoms, Times Square Arts, and Poster House. And it was a series of works that were commissioned to be displayed on digital screens throughout all five boroughs of New York City, and also on screens throughout New York, Boston, and Chicago. Each artwork acknowledges the continued service of essential workers. So I want to also just pause really quickly to talk a little bit about Christine's work. She's just such an incredible artist, and I really want to give her a little moment here. So if you're not familiar with Christine, Christine often creates scores that translate linguistic utterances or everyday musical sounds into different lines and notes. She thinks spatially around the qualities of American Sign Language in particular, which is her first language, in which, like many systems of musical notation and language, is inherently very limited. And she works with this idea of limitation or sparseness as a means of expression, and actually as a form of inquiry and critique that I think is really powerful. So for this work, there's five hand-drawn notes stacked one on top of the other, stretching across the full span of the screen in Times Square. And from a distance, it appears to almost mimic the five lines of a blank musical staff as well. It's dynamic in that on the right, there's a flashing thank. On the left note, there's a flashing you. And they sort of go back and forth, almost mimicking the rhythm of a clap of applause. So obviously, you know, over the course of the shutdown and the shelter in place in New York and other places, as well as San Francisco, people were applauding at 7 o'clock and really trying to make that the moment to thank all of the essential workers that were keeping everything going. So there's a little bit of a reference to that, but also the blankness that's between the lines and the sort of empty space that's really spanning long and wide really invites a kind of silent reflection, a kind of reverence, a kind of mourning. And I think it's just, you know, in such a simple and very graphic image, it does so much. And that's really, I think, what crystallizes Christine's practice. She does so much with very little. So I just wanted to say as well that Christine is also a prominent advocate for the deaf and disability community. She wrote a very scathing op-ed this year that was fantastic in the New York Times, following her experience of live signing the Star Spangled Banner at the Super Bowl and having the cameras focus on her for the length of a blink of an eye. And it was really terrible. So Again, if you're not already familiar with Christine's work, I very much encourage you to follow it and to read this op-ed. So lastly, on Four Freedoms, I just wanted to say I really encourage people to also sign up for their newsletter. They are distributing so many helpful resources right now of all kinds, pointing people to, you know, different kind of political petitions and resources and Kickstarters, fundraising, and hosting or facilitating or just kind of amplifying the different amazing public programs that are taking place virtually right now and with lots of other artists. So again, they're an incredible hub of information. And I hope some of you will connect with them.
You're listening to Democracy Sounds Good, a conversation on artists, arts, and activism with curators Heidi Rabin and Kinjin Montoya from the Contemporary Jewish Museum. On Bina, a series featuring creative voices from the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org.
So an artist I'm really excited to talk about today is the artist Colleen Smith. She's trained as a filmmaker and is a multidisciplinary artist working with moving images, installation, textile, drawing, and performance. She deliberately positions community and community gathering as the methodology for political, artistic, and cultural liberation. She really challenges traditional forms of expression by centering these community gatherings and these moments of togetherness. And how one shares space with other people is really important to the way she works. Of her work, she's described her subjects as, quote, the fragile, the forgotten, the flawed, and the fugitive, which I just really love. She also spent some time in Sacramento, so if she ever wants to talk about growing up in Sacramento, she can find me here. So this was one of the films I was able to research for a different project at the beginning of the year, looking over Colleen's work. It's called Pilgrim. It's just really beautiful, the imagery and the sound. The entire length of the film is the length of a song that's written and performed by Alice Coltrane, dedicated to her late husband, John Coltrane. And there's no narration besides Alice kind of introducing the song, and then she starts playing. The film takes you to three distinct places, and it sort of looks like kind of a dreamlike sequence. So the ashram that actually Alice Coltrane would go to in Agoura Hills in California is one of the spaces. And like I said, it's sort of dreamlike, these kind of hazy, empty spaces. Smith takes us also to the iconic Watts Towers in Los Angeles that, of course, they're imbued with cultural and historical legacy in and of themselves. And then it moves over to a cemetery in New York, specifically focusing on the headstone of a Shaker community leader, Mother Ann Lee, from the 1700s. And so this film has a group of people working on it, had a group of people working on it on Smith's vision, including Arthur Jaffa, who worked on the cinematography of the ashram scenes. So it's really just this visual audio pleasure to experience. But upon first watching, again, this was before Shelter in Place, this was earlier this year, and one of the things that I immediately noticed was that these three places were a place for gathering of some kind. They were a place for the public to commune, but in the film, they are empty. So while I immediately noticed that about all three locations, my next thought was, wondering what the connection between them all are, because they seem so disparate in so many ways. And then, of course, thinking about the empty spaces now, they've taken on a whole new meaning. We all have a totally different idea of what it means to have an empty public space. The fact that it becomes almost a political action to populate a public space right now. And then the stakes get even higher when you think about spaces for communing that have to do with worship, places to come together for death, and places that are charged with a racial or cultural legacy. So just the imagery alone and the locations are already kind of imbued in a whole new way, really beautifully. But as Shelter in Place started, I was doing a little bit more research and really got into the whole quarantine rabbit hole of being able to look at just about everything Colleen has online. Anytime she's chatted up with someone or she's been on a few panels as well. And one of the connections that she mentions in an interview about Pilgrim is this intergenerational spiritual journey. So Alice Coltrane is very well known to speak about astral travel and kind of out of this world experiences. She and John Coltrane were very spiritual, and kind of apart from that, Smith found a journal by Mother Ann Lee from the 1770s, also discussing these visions of kind of planetary travel, out of the planet, kind of leaving her body, seeing the Earth down below. And so there's this idea that Colleen was trying to connect that while we're in our bodies, we can connect intergenerationally throughout space, or even in a timeless space, in a moment that's meditative and isolated in some ways can be very uncomfortable. But that in doing that, you do actually create a connection with someone else who's maybe done that kind of work. And so this idea that our bodies can sit in discomfort and our mind can sit in discomfort really carry through a lot of her work. So we'll move on to a next work. And as I was chatting about this with Heidi early in this process, she let me know about the Human 3.0 reading list that I hadn't delved completely into yet. So this is another work by Colleen Smith. It was created over 18 months from 2015 to 2016. It's a series of 57 graphite and watercolor drawings on graph paper. And they each represent a book that she's read. So again, when we talk about guides and resources that we've kind of come upon through artists and their work, this is really something that people can look to. Again, we mentioned it at the beginning, it is literally a list of books. She also hand drew them, which is a really important aspect of the work because it brings back this idea of mindful engagement and kind of going against these quick kind of consumable images that we are drawn to or that we're kind of pulled towards right now with technology. And so it's this idea of internalizing and manifesting a resource and really kind of connecting to it. So, and because it is literally a list of books, people are familiar with the format, right? We all know like top 10 and have I read this and what's number one and what do they have in common and what are they missing? So with this particular list of books that Smith has put together, it really shows the power of collective consciousness. That's a through line within the books, and it really does point to people, to the viewer at least, you know, under what context have you read it, what kind of titles would you say are missing or that you would add to it. And Heidi, I feel like you really had a connection to this work when you were sharing it.
Yeah, thank you. I just wanted to say, I think one of the things that I came across this body of work in 2017 when I was initiating a feminist sci-fi book club. And that's one thing that I really love about Colleen's work is that she's not just saying, you know, here's all the things that are nonfiction or, historical accounts of the ways that we sort of engage in the present. She's really looking to creative writers and to science fiction writers as a way to help really feel the different potentials that we have as a society. I think people like Octavia Butler, people like Samuel R. Delaney, who are part of this list, have been really instrumental for her thinking, for my thinking, in the ways that we can imagine a real way forward. And that, you know, we're all seeing so many different reading lists right now, and they're all immensely helpful. But what I love about Colleen's is that it is not exclusively about one thing. It's really about like Human 3.0. How do we become better people? And if everybody, these are the books that really made her feel like she was becoming a better person. And if we all read these same things and had a shared sort of baseline understanding of the potential in this world and the ways that we can envision our future, it's a very optimistic take, even though it comes from sort of, you know, a place of frustration and pessimism. But she even says that in the way that she talks about the reading list, that, you know, this is like, if you're going to do this is like, let's look at this in a way that we can get out of this together. And how can we keep moving forward? So I really appreciate that about it.
Yeah, I totally agree. I'll send it back to Heidi.
Thank you. And thanks for talking. I love talking about Colleen. That's great. So the next artist that I was going to talk about is Julie Weitz. Julie Weitz is a Los Angeles-based artist whose practice spans several different media, including video, film, performance, and installation. Her practice is very deeply rooted in Jewish folklore, mysticism, humor, and ritual. Weitz herself is also a writer and an educator and an activist, and all of these different parts of her person really come to bear on the work that she creates as an artist. So her current project that she's been working on since 2017 focuses on her embodiment and portrayal of a futuristic folkloric humanoid named My Golem. For those that are not familiar, golems are significant to Jewish mythology. They generally take the form as something akin to like an unfinished anthropomorphic creature, which is often formed by mud or clay by their creator. And the interpretation of both the creature itself throughout history and its meaning are so widely varied. So at times the golem can be obedient and protective. At other times it is fully disobedient and even villainous. So it's a very expansive subject to sort of embark upon. Julie's particular golem was created in 2017 as a response to rising anti-Semitism. And since that time, the project has evolved through a series of commissioned works exploring the golem mythology as an empowerment fantasy. And this is really where I find this project so exciting and so rich. From Golem, A Call to Action, one of the most recent golem iterations. And here we are seeing the golem confronting ecological disaster and framing a moral imperative for action around climate change and particularly wildfire policy through the lens of her golem, who is trained as a firefighter to promote education around controlled burns and in preventing increasingly catastrophic California wildfires. So obviously something that feels particularly relevant at this very moment. So you see the golem situated actually in the Tahoe National Forest in their Jewish firefighter outfit and blowing a very large shofar, which is a Jewish ram's horn trumpet, which is usually sounded on the occasion of Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. So even though every new golem initiative is entirely distinct from the last, the thing that's consistent about the golem is that it confronts contemporary cultural issues and with the idea of the pursuit of social justice. And Julie directly references the Jewish imperative of tikkun olam, which means in Hebrew roughly translates to heal or to repair the world. So again, really thinking about also the Jewish legacy of social justice. The golem has confronted, as I mentioned, climate change, has protested ICE and the policing system, taking the form of a firefighter, the great dominatrix, all of these different sorts of characters in addition to the character of the golem itself. So the thing that I really love about this idea that Julie's working through is that it seems to me that the golem is almost acting as a vessel or a container for Julie herself to explore the various feelings or the different traumas that injustice produces in her, and I think in our collective sort of consciousness. So it's more than just sort of a surrogate or a performative alter ego. It's almost like a way of her personifying the place in our minds where we compartmentalize anxiety, excitement, fear, joy, you know, all of these different feelings and complex emotions that we're grappling with, dealing with the kinds of intensity and rapid conflation of things changing in the world. Can be very overwhelming. So another one of the things that I really love about the golem is that it's not actually exclusively just an artistic performance. Weitz is also deploying this character on the ground for her own activist participation by dressing in full costume and going to or organizing protests herself related to the many issues that the golem is addressing. So you actually see Weitz as her golem in Adelanto, California, again, protesting against ICE, fighting to abolish ICE and to release the captive immigrants in detention in Adelanto. And then you're also seeing kind of some participation from Julie independent of her golem. So Julie herself recently started the Jews for Black Lives Instagram account on May 31st in conversation with a core group of Jewish activists that she had been organizing with through the Never Again Action. It sprung out of a need for the Jewish communities to support the movement for Black lives while also struggling to understand their positionality as Jews and the intersectionality with anti-Semitism. So at this point, their goal is to be an information hub nationally for Jews that are in solidarity with Black Lives Matter, and also locally to promote in-person actions in Los Angeles. They have a bunch of upcoming collaborations with other Jewish organizations like Bend the Ark, Zedek Lab, and Spill the Honey. So by all means, if you're interested, please follow at Jews for Black Lives. So I think that's a really great transition into the next artist that Kinjin's going to talk about.
So my next artist is, I'm also very excited about, Morgan Basikis, is a solo artist out of New York. They also do a lot of collaborative work. They have a few albums with other artists and other musicians. They often perform with other artists on stage, and their work is based on the idea of collective community and the critical potential of humor. They pull from stand-up comedy, music, including collective singing, introspection, self-help, and institutional and social critique. They were included in the 2019 Whitney Biennial and are currently a fellow at the Headlands. This is, just to give context of the performances, this is Morgan with child star Helen Messineo-Pangiris in 2018 performing Damned If You Duet, one of Morgan's performances at the Kitchen in New York. You can see the Free Everyone sign that Helen's holding and Morgan's fist in the air. Often current events and other kind of social justice issues will come up, anything from the horrors of ICE, caging families and children, like Heidi had mentioned, and the effects of the prison industrial complex. These all really play a role in Morgan's work. I was lucky enough to participate. Morgan came, was invited by Caddis to do a presentation. It was really wonderful last year. And you can also see the kind of intimate setting that the performances allow for. It feels really personal. Morgan has you kind of yell out things that are that you're dealing with on your day-to-day. So Morgan's performance had a lot to do with Bay Bridge traffic and, you know, trying to plan for San Francisco weather. And Morgan also has an exquisite voice and plays the piano very well. They're very talented in so many ways. But what I wanted to talk about in this particular segment about them is that at the beginning of Shelter in Place, I think it was the day San Francisco ordered their shelter in place, I think it was March 15th or 14th, Morgan began posting what became known as quarantunes on their Instagram, which were short conversational songs, basically posted to Instagram, but they were really taking like a moment to moment approach to all the chaos that was breaking out and that still feels very much is happening, and really made it a moment to connect. So anything from learning how to use the tech to communicate with people more often and social media and things like that, to acknowledging that a lot of us were probably pretty stressed out by things even before all of this started. So we'll start with the first video.
I have a big update. As you can see, figured out how to press record and play, so there's going to be a lot more drag in church, which I know some of us feel negative about. Drag in church. If you're feeling down, if you're feeling down, if you're always feeling down, because we were all depressed and suicidal before this, and it got
offering a song there at the end. It does this play of, like, you know, as a captive audience and you're on this platform that's inherently meant to be very public, Morgan was really turning them into these really intimate conversations. They went on to do one that talks about other things that were happening during shelter in place, which was us feeling very disconnected from our friends, our family, while in the back, maybe not the background, maybe it was the foreground for many of us, a kind of growing displeasure at the way our country was being governed and kind of in the ways that we were led here and not led back out. So we can play the next one.
If you are missing your friends, if you are missing your friends, if you are missing your friends, here are some things you can do to feel closer.
You can send them daily pictures of your psoriasis to keep them updated, or videos. You can hatch a plan, you can hatch a plan, you can hatch a plan to overthrow the American Empire. It's the biggest barrier, the biggest barrier to friendship. Or you can make a plan to hang out and then just cancel it. For old time's sake, for old time's sake, for old time's sake. If you are missing your friends, if you are missing your friends, if you are missing your friends.
This is Bina, KALW series featuring artists and thinkers who've spoken at the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. Today's program is Democracy Sounds Good, a conversation on artists, arts, and activism with curators Heidi Rabin and Kinjin Matoya from the Contemporary Jewish Museum. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org.
So, again, yeah, they're these short little videos, very conversational. They were often one or two a day. And this next one was particularly helpful for me because I know the first month of shelter in place was really difficult to get kind of a normal sleep stage going. And again, this is the way that Morgan works all the time. It just really lent itself to people needing these moments to kind of not just connect with someone else, but have like moments of introspection that weren't as, like I said, chaotic and scary, quite frankly. And so this next one was really very helpful to me.
I know it's weird, 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 I know it's weird to go to bed now. To go to bed now. I know it's weird, I know it's weird, I know it's weird, I know it's weird, I know it's weird to go to bed now. To go to bed now.
Yeah, so even if you're just listening for that beautiful voice, it's really wonderful. This last one is, again, they were posted pretty regularly over 2 months, I'd say probably about mid-May. And then past that, they're still kind of interspersed on their Instagram, but they've also started to put up a lot more calls to action as our kind of world has also shifted from maybe viewing and watching the things that are going on in the world and then having to actively participate in order to make change happen. And so I also really appreciate them embedding that into their practice as well, becoming this resource for people to get to know them, but then also get to know the kinds of things that are important to be a part of and be in the discussion of. So this last one, they made fun or kind of poked fun at some of the hobbies going on during shelter in place, this idea that we're stuck at home with plants, books, baking bread. But there's also this tinge of introspection and kind of self-help that I really appreciated. So this will be the last one.
If you're feeling sad or bad because you haven't grown your own cashews and turned them into muffins or slaughtered your own vegan beef, if you haven't done that, if you haven't invented your own Zoom platform, don't worry, we have a solution. I mean, there's always a solution. Get a stack of your should books off the shelf. Get your should books off the shelf. Put them in your lap. And you just open up one at a time and you just read one sentence. That's all we're asking. One sentence. The problems with attachment are many. I never asked her what book she had read. I never asked her what book she had read.
Yeah, so again, I encourage everyone to follow their Instagram and check out their profile at the Headlands website. And yeah, and I'll turn it back to Heidi.
So even though we work at a museum, I think Kindred and I really wanted to speak a little bit about the realm of monuments and about public art in this particular moment, in part because these forms are providing a way to experience art in person safely while we're all experiencing isolation. You can do it on your own time. You can do it in a very kind of controlled and at your own pace way. But I think also because their formats are being really deeply challenged by the present circumstances of our world in a way that I find very exciting, frankly. So a statue of Francis Scott Key in Golden Gate Park that was downed by protesters. Francis Scott Key was the composer of the Star Spangled Banner, but also a slave owner. And so there's just been a really large outcry across the country around the validity of monuments and really a lot of activists trying to take them down. Similarly, this is just the empty pedestal that used to house the statue of Christopher Columbus that was removed by the city on June 18th after a lot of vandalism and defacement that even happened before 2020. But just kind of to illustrate again, this is happening all across the country and here in our own city in particular. And these actions have both really shone a light on the complex history of our nation's founding. And quite excitingly, again, in my opinion, they've created space about how we can think about what we want from memorials and monuments and artworks that we would want to actually see in their place if we didn't just sort of accept that they were here. So what could we envision if we are actively working towards becoming an anti-racist society? So quickly, one organization I really wanted to point to with that in mind is one called Monument Lab, which is based in Philadelphia. They are an independent public art and history studio that are based in Philly, founded by Paul Farber and Ken Lum, who are artists. So they work with different artists, students, activists, municipal agencies, and cultural institutions to try to take an exploratory approach to public engagement and collective memory, really questioning, again, what the status of the monument is. The work that they did with the artist Mel Chin, titled To Me, T-W-O Me, and it invited members of the public to pose as living monuments on one of two platforms called granite pedestals that have the word me inscribed on them. What I really like about this work is that it's trying to symbolize and sort of problematize the distinctly American longing for individualism and coexistence at the same time. And how do we combat those two impulses as part of our identity as a country, as part of our founding? All the more resonant because the two documents that really draft these ideas were drafted in Philadelphia. So those being the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution respectively. So it's a really, you know, site-specific and very poignant and also kind of playful way of engaging the idea of monuments. Likewise, there's a really interesting organization called History is Illuminating in Richmond, Virginia, who sort of guerrilla style erects placards that are either sort of recontextualizing existing monuments in the city to better reflect the truth of their problematic origins, or they try to create placards for locations that maybe should have a monument for a different kind of purpose and sort of serve underrepresented communities in their histories. So the way that they are sort of recontextualizing, visiting the former Stonewall Jackson Monument. That monument has already been removed, which was one of the biggest symbols in Virginia and the former American South amongst the last month's removal of many monuments. And lastly, on the subject of monuments, I just wanted to say, you know, as we're walking through our own city, this is really a reminder not to take the version of this country's history or the city's history that at least the majority of us have been taught at face value, literally. And sort of invite you that when you are seeing a statue or a monument, to try to look really critically, look closely, read the provided placard or information, and then ask yourself, you know, who is telling the story and why? Who paid for this sculpture? Whose story or perspective might be missing? Ask yourself what else might occupy that space and in the service or what or of who. And this is a proposal for a monument that was supposed to honor Maya Angelou by the artist Lava Thomas. This was selected unanimously by a panel and was sort of taken all the way up to Supervisor Catherine Stephanie, who unfortunately rejected the proposal on the grounds that it was not figurative enough, a qualification that was not a part of the RFP, of course, in the part of the creation of this monument. So it was a really unfortunate circumstance that happened. It was a miscommunication. It was handled really terribly. It continues to be handled pretty terribly. And there's a great organization called See Black Women that I encourage everyone to follow, which are continuing to actually advocate on Lava's behalf around the mishandling of this civic issue. Kinjin and I just anecdotally also both attended a meeting of the Board of Supervisors to voice our support of Lava, which was fascinating. If no one has done that, I encourage you just to at least know what the Board of Supervisors does and the variety of things that they're discussing in their weekly meetings. So it was very enlightening, and there's still a lot more work to do. But I'm going to turn it over to Kinjin to talk very quickly about some public art projects before we conclude.
Yeah, perfect. Thank you. So hopefully people have seen it around for those in San Francisco. Is a collaboration by artists Marcela Pardo Ariza, Juan Carlos Rodriguez Rivera, and Felipe Garcia Jr. And it began as these artists were kind of walking around the city as shelter in place began and seeing their friends' businesses, basically, in places that they would go to a lot, being boarded up, obviously, with the shelter-in-place orders. And what they decided to do was kind of combine the messages they were getting from these business owners through their social medias, which were words of encouragement and community, and excerpt from those messages and we paste them onto their doors. So it, again, deals with this strangeness of disconnect, this kind of abrupt shift to screens from gathering physically. And through this collective expression, it uses public space in a different way. It shifts it to offer messages of interconnectedness and between the business and the community. So it's a kind of a reminder that these businesses are for gathering and that they will hopefully be back. And yeah, again, if you go to their website, there's a map that shows where they all are. So as Heidi and I were discussing this before, she mentioned it really is kind of it does have this positive spin of like, you know, these spaces are for gathering, are for the public, and that they will be back. So these spaces are, while they're not populated at the moment in the way that they're meant to be, they are still for us, which is a great, great message. They do have the posters available for sale, and which each of them having some of the funds going to different organizations around the city. So, and that's about it on those.
Really quick, another billboard project that's really great in the city called Premier Junior, and its current exhibition with Aria Original is actually talking, of course, about justice for Sean Monterosa. So those that are not familiar, Sean was a 22-year-old resident of San Francisco who was fatally shot by Vallejo police officer Jarrett Tawn. His death occurred at the beginning of a national uprising with protests around the world calling for justice and an end to police violence. So the artist in 2014, Aria Original, launched the Justice for Our Lives campaign of sorts. It was an open source digital portrait series of people who have been killed by US law enforcement. Inspired by Black Lives Matter activism, the black and white portraits serve as pivotal instruments in the fight for justice against state-sponsored terrorism. And something really quick to note is that at the time of install for the billboard on Premier Junior Verso, so the other side of it, was a recruitment ad for the Contra Costa Sheriff's Department. And also, you know, obviously couldn't be more, I don't know if it was intentional or coincidental, either way, it is very poignant. And just to say that Premier Junior is run by Bay Area artists and curators, Sarah Hotchkiss and Zoe Teleporos. Okay, now for real, the last one. The last thing I wanted to say, I'm sure everyone is so familiar with the public art that has crept up in your own neighborhoods in this moment. And this organization called Paint the Void is one that sprung up in April, just really trying to do the effort of connecting artists to business owners that were boarding up their storefronts and really had a ton of blank space. So this, for me, it kind of sprung up within a matter of days in my own neighborhood. There were a ton of businesses boarded up. It felt like, you know, so much anxiety and sadness and fear. And then within days, it was totally transformed. So I wanted to just talk about this one mural that is covering the Buffalo Exchange and the Mission. The design in the center is actually inspired by the Navajo Nation seal and some of their healing sand paintings. It's also somewhat kind of anecdotally inspired by the bison who are in Golden Gate Park, that are in Golden Gate Park. They are also, this mural company, the Twin Walls Mural Company, are going to make some prints, and all the proceeds will go to the Navajo and Hopi Relief Fund and the National Indigenous Women's Resource Center. So please check them out and follow that. So just to say, Paint the Void offers a map where you can actually see all the different murals that they have worked with. Of course, there are tons of other organizations or just people that are freely doing art in the city. This is not the only resource. San Francisco Arts Commission also provides a map of public art in the city, and you can search by your district to sort of see that. But the point is, what we are trying to say is, you know, there's still ways for you to see art in person, even while institutions like ours are closed, while museums are closed, while other sort of main sources of artistic access are closed. And also to say that, you know, even though larger institutions have to remain closed at this moment, there are tons of independent galleries, small, you know, nonprofits that actually are open to the public. You just have to make an appointment to be able to maintain distance. So please look around in your local community and try to support those organizations as well. Many of those go directly towards supporting the livelihood of local artists. And then lastly, you know, we've already talked about it a bit, but there are plenty of online exhibitions, artists on social media, all of that. To me, I just want to say it will never replace art in person, and that's not meant to. But as we discussed today, it does nevertheless provide a lot of options for connection and for resources at this time and for dialogue. So
thank you, Kinjin and Heidi, for that wonderful introduction to artists and social practice, and especially now how artists are responding to this situation in the world. It's great. It's always great to learn about artists, but this talk felt especially profound right now. So thank you very, very much. Thank you very much for joining us today for Democracy Sounds Good. Our next edition will be in October, date TBD. So stay tuned and check our website and to find out about it. So yes, thank you, audience, for joining us for Democracy Sounds Good.
BINA is a co-production of the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco and KALW. For more information about programs at the JCCSF, you can visit jccsf.org. Today's program was Democracy Sounds Good, a conversation on artists, arts, and activism with curators Heidi Rabin and Kinjin Montoya from the Contemporary Jewish Museum. To learn more about the CJM's Democracy Sounds Good series and other upcoming events, go to thecjm.org. We will also have some links to the artists discussed in this hour on the KALW website at kalw.org/BINA. I'm David Kwan, editor and producer of the program, and Tina Pamintuan is the executive producer. Our theme music is from the album Masada Rock by the Roshanim Trio, and the music you're hearing right now is by John Zorn. BINA is available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org. Thanks for listening.